We're going to Capitol Hill now to talk about a tariffs bill introduced yesterday. You're with us on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Lawmakers on both sides of the aisle have introduced legislation that would require President Trump to get congressional approval before taking steps to impose tariffs or do other trade actions. We'll get the details on this bill from one of its co-sponsors. Congressman Mike Gallagher is joining us. And while we're at it, we'll ask him about other developments on the Hill, like where things stand with negotiations on a border security package ahead of that February 15th deadline. And you have a line at 800-642-1234. On that debate over border, what strategy do you think is best? Are you following the trade negotiations happening with China? What do you hope the final deal looks like? And what questions do you have for Congressman Gallagher about trade, about healthcare, foreign policy? Call in. You can email ideas at WPR.org. U.S. Congressman Mike Gallagher is a Republican serving Wisconsin's 8th Congressional District that covers Marinette County, Green Bay, and Appleton and the surrounding area, where it is 24 below zero with a wind chill of minus 43. Representative Gallagher, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me. I hope you are indoors and staying warm.
Look, I'm just trying to bring you closer to your constituents, feeling like what they feel, right? Right? I'm setting the scene for you. I don't want you to feel what they feel. No. So just yesterday, Representative Ron Kind and other members of Congress from both parties introduced the bicameral Congressional Trade Authority Act. What would this bill accomplish?
So it's important to distinguish between two things that are going on right now. There's a so-called Section 301 tariffs, which are designed to counter China. This bill does not touch those. I'm largely supportive of our efforts to get tough on China. But the second thing is the Section 232 tariffs, which are the steel and aluminum tariffs that we've placed largely on our allies, which I believe have been very destructive to Wisconsin farmers and Wisconsin manufacturers, and also these are the tariffs that the president has imposed under a national security justification. He said we face a national security threat from steel and aluminum. I don't think that's true. And so what this bill would do would require Congress to actually vote on any imposition of tariffs under Section 232. And if the executive branch is not able to secure the approval of Congress, then these tariffs do not go into effect. It would be retroactive 4 years. It would also shift the responsibility for conducting the 232 investigation to the Department of Defense as opposed to the Department of Commerce. And so what's really going on here is an effort by me, Representative Kine, and many others to claw back some of this authority that Congress has consistently surrendered to the executive branch on trade. And after all, under the Constitution, we have the authority to regulate commerce with foreign nations. We've given that up over the last 100 years, ironically, as part of a trade liberalizing measure. And regardless of how you feel about tariffs, whether you think they're good or bad, I think it's obvious that you should want the elected representatives of the American people in the most accountable branch of government to have a greater say in how this unfolds. And that's what we're trying to accomplish. And I think, and this is the final thing I'll say, I'm sorry to go on here, I want to enhance the president's ability to be successful in the effort against China. And I think picking a fight with our allies simultaneously undermines that. And so I think by settling the 232 issue, we can actually enhance the 301 issue, if that makes sense.
Okay, so before we get, though, to China and talking about China and the trade war there, you're looking at the Section 232 talking tariffs. We saw what happened there with Harley Davidson. Is this legislation, will it help farmers who have lost buyers for their crops and products? Is there any peace of mind you can give to, like, soybean and ginseng farmers who are listening?
Well, I think the sooner we resolve the ongoing disputes on 232, the better position our farmers and manufacturers are going to be in. I mean, we have dairy farmers that have lost orders and market access in places like Mexico. And if we can resolve 232, perhaps they can begin to claw that back. But every day we allow this to go on, you know, you have Mexican customers that grow accustomed to buying from other people besides Wisconsin dairy farmers. And that, to me, is counterproductive. U.S. importers have been forced to pay an additional taxes on roughly $23 billion in steel imports and $17 billion in aluminum imports. And so do I think this will solve everything? No, but I think it will help. And again, I think it will ultimately enhance our position in order to get tough with China and also put our domestic manufacturers and farmers in a better position over the long term and ensure we don't go down this road again in the future unless Congress says, okay, this makes sense. We are okay with you going forward on this. This is a more equitable distribution of power between the executive branch and the legislative branch.
Your Republican colleague, Representative Sean Duffy, who represents North Central Wisconsin, proposed basically contrasting legislation, if we're looking at this correctly. His bill would allow the White House more tariff authority. Why do you oppose his plan?
Well, I think it's important to know. I think Sean and I have the exact same goal, which is to say we want a level playing field for Wisconsin manufacturers and farmers. I think we just have a slight disagreement on how to get there. I think by vesting the power back in Congress, we'll have a more responsible trade policy. Sean seems to believe that we need to give the administration more authority to threaten our allies with countervailing tariffs. He's right to suggest that on certain goods, our allies have far greater tariffs than we do. In many cases, though, if you average it out, our applied tariffs are lower than those of the EU and Canada. So there's no disagreement about the ultimate goal. It's just a slight disagreement about how to get there.
Talking with Congressman Mike Gallagher, who joins us to talk about the new trade bill he co-sponsored and other issues that Congress is working on. The bicameral Congressional Trade Authority Act was introduced yesterday. Republican Senator Pat Toomey of Pennsylvania co-sponsored the Senate bill. Representative Gallagher is co-sponsor on the House version. And by the way, so is his Democratic colleague Ron Kind of Wisconsin. You have a line at 800-642-1234. Are you a farmer? Do you work in manufacturing? Have you felt the effects of the trade war? Call in, email ideas at WPR.org. Let's look for a moment at China. Trade negotiations with China began this week in Washington. Those talks are happening after we learned about charges the Justice Department is bringing against Chinese tech giant Huawei. What are you hoping U.S. negotiators accomplish this week?
Well, these are critical negotiations, and in the past two rounds, I think the Chinese felt like they had a deal with the administration only to have it changed. I hope the administration drives a hard line, but really we have to look at what matters. What are we most concerned about with respect to China? It's actually not their tariffs. It's their non-tariff barriers. It's things like their massive intellectual property theft. It's their subsidization of state-owned enterprises, and it's what they demand in return for market access, in addition to broader counterintelligence concerns it raises. So I actually published a piece this morning talking about China's efforts to expand its global access. And one way we see this is by their so-called Digital Silk Road Initiative, which just aims, this is a signature initiative of Chairman Xi Jinping that aims to build information and communications technology infrastructure, particularly in developing countries, not from an altruistic perspective, but they facilitate technology transfer that robs foreign firms of intellectual property. They promote Chinese technical standards. They advantage Chinese firms. And so state-owned or state-affiliated firms like Huawei or ZTE get an advantageous position while spying on us, which is why I've introduced bipartisan legislation to hold Chinese Communist Party telecom firms accountable for any malign activities such as sanctions evasions. And I think we're just beginning to wake up to the massive scale of the threat that is posed by companies like Huawei and ZTE. And the arrests in Canada, in Poland, are the best evidence of that fact. And so at some point, we're going to have to resolve this. And so I salute the administration for taking a hardline approach. I honestly don't know what's going to come out of this latest round of negotiations, but it's long past time that we have woken up to the concern posed by the Chinese Communist Party.
We're talking tariffs, we're talking trade, federal budget, and more with Representative Mike Gallagher. You have a line at 800-642-1234. What would you like to see from Congress now that it's back in session? Should something be done to ensure future shutdowns are less painful? Call in. We'll get back to the conversation in a minute on the Ideas Network. We have Congressman Mike Gallagher on the line with us from Washington here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We've been talking about new legislation he co-sponsored yesterday on tariffs. We're talking through other developments on the Hill that affect Wisconsinites, including the government shutdown and the negotiations underway on border wall funding. What would you like to ask the congressman? 800-642-1234. Perhaps it's about health care, about foreign policy. Perhaps the Mueller investigation is on your mind. You can join in, tweet us at WPR Mornings. So let's look at the border situation, what we have here. We've just come out of the longest federal government shutdown in history. We saw the Congressional Budget Office figures reveal the shutdown cost the economy $3 billion. Lots of anecdotes from federal employees feeling trapped. Democrats in the House offered a border security plan yesterday that would not provide a penny for the wall. What deal would you like to see come to fruition on border security?
Well, I think any deal has to involve some amount of physical border security. What the president is proposing is not one gigantic concrete wall running coast to coast. And I went to the White House. The president was there, the vice president there. We had five Democrats, five Republicans. And it was clear to me that we're just sort of speaking a different language. You know, my Democratic colleagues will say, well, we don't support the wall, but we do support physical border security. Well, if that's the case, what are we disagreeing about, right? And this is actually a relatively solvable problem. It's sort of the best debate you want to have, because it's not a debate about abstract principles. It's about specific things we can measure in terms of geography, human resources, and costs. Having spent a significant amount of time at the southern border when I was in uniform, I can tell you it's not secure. And any solution will involve a mix of physical border security, technology, enhanced personnel, and critically personnel to our court system, our immigration court system. Because the real crisis we face now is one that starts in Central America and winds up with people claiming asylum at ports of entry. And so the White House actually did put forth a nuanced proposal. I understand when you use the word wall, it turns a lot of people off, but it has to have some measure of physical border security. And in return, I think there could be a solution on the DACA issue. That sort of framework makes a lot of sense to me. That sort of DACA for physical border security makes sense, but it just strikes me that we're not any closer to getting a solution after this shutdown. And people would rather use this issue to score political points than solve the problem and move on to the much bigger problems we face, right? If we can't solve this matter of $5.7 billion, how are we going to get on to lowering drug prices, fixing health care, restoring our military? I mean, those are the big challenges we face.
So if push comes to shove here, if Congress can come to a deal by this next deadline, February 15th, will you go with shutting down the government again? Will you vote for that?
I'd have to see what proposals are on the table. I hope we can avoid that. I mean, that would be the sort of the literal definition of insanity if it gets us nowhere. But I just don't know what's being proposed right now. And my fundamental problem that I've said from the start is that this is all top down, right? We have a group of about four people that are negotiating largely in secret while the rest of us rank and file members await white smoke to emerge from the chimney of the White House, right? That's not a recipe for success. This should be from the bottom up. You need to go back to the committees of jurisdiction. You need to go back to the more junior members. You need to try and forge that consensus from the bottom up. That is the best chance you have of getting a compromise and also having that compromise last. And I fear that if we don't do that, then the administration is going to invoke a national emergency to do this through executive order. And that will just continue the distortion of our Constitution that we've seen for the better part of the last 60 years, which is to say Congress surrenders its power and everything is done through executive fiat, which works well if you happen to agree with who's in the White House at present. But then the next person that occupies that position you don't agree with can completely reverse that, right? So, for example, Republicans were not that enthusiastic when Obama did things on immigration through executive order. And so it just sets a bad precedent. And it also allows Congress to wash its hands of any responsibility, thereby reducing the likelihood that this institution will be productive in the future.
So you introduced the Serve the People, Not the Swamp Act, which, if signed into law, would prevent Congress from going into recess without first adapting a balanced federal budget. Why do you think this bill is necessary? What would it do?
Because we keep making the same mistakes over and over again, right? This was an entirely predictable crisis, and we waited till the last second to even begin negotiations over border security. We always wait to the last second to fund the government, or we put it on autopilot through continuing resolutions, which is actually destructive and wasteful of taxpayer money. So we need to break out of this destructive cycle. We need to change the process through which Congress operates. And so what I'm proposing to change the paradigm are simple things like ending congressional pensions, so members aren't incentivized to stay there forever, so they can actually exercise some intellectual honesty and maybe take some risk occasionally and use their brain before they spout off on cable news. I'm also proposing a ban on lobbying for former members of Congress so that people don't use the office as a stepping stone to get rich, to enrich themselves, and therefore their votes are tainted by the expectation of material wealth. Simple things like no budget, no pay. If we don't pass a budget on time, then we are not allowed to go on recess for the entire month of August. This is just Wisconsin common sense to me, but in D.C., common sense is an uncommon virtue.
Okay, so we're short on time here. Let's move into health care. The Urban Institute is out with new data that says Affordable Care Act exchanges are expecting a stable year, but many Americans with disabilities and pre-existing conditions, they're really concerned about their future of a ruling that overturns the ACA if that remains in place. What do you want to happen here with the ACA and where we're headed to next?
I think any healthcare reform going forward has to start from the position, the unequivocal position, that we will protect people with pre-existing conditions. So let's just state that at the outset. Now, the challenge is, how do we do that while also reducing healthcare costs over the long term so that we don't bankrupt our entire country, right? We're spending 18% of our GDP on healthcare. The average among advanced industrialized countries is closer to 8%. So how do we do that? To me, it all starts with transparency. Transparency in pricing. Because the fundamental problem in healthcare, from my perspective, is that none of us as patients can decipher our medical bills when we get them. We have no idea where the money is going. And let's be honest, there are a lot of insurance companies and big hospitals that have gotten rich over the last few years, even as our overall healthcare system has gotten worse. And so it all starts with transparency for me. I have a bipartisan bill on mandating transparency and pricing, but I think we need to go beyond that to require insurers to provide more information to hospital systems so they can manage their patient populations as such a population. And also transparency, I would say, in a third dimension, between employees and their employers. Employees should know exactly how much employers are spending on their healthcare so they can make more responsible healthcare decisions. So if we get that, and if we simultaneously tackle the social determinants of healthcare, i.e. the fact that your exercise and your diet actually matter a lot more for your health than the type of insurance you have, then we can start to bend that cost curve down. But ultimately, it has to start with that principled commitment to protecting people with pre-existing conditions. As a conservative, I start from the principled position that Ronald Reagan articulated in the mid-1980s, which is to say no one in this country should be denied health care because of a lack of money. We can fix this problem, but we need people to stop demagoguing the issue.
Let's look at U.S. intelligence agencies for a moment here. They released the worldwide threat assessment that said the Trump administration trade policies have strained traditional relationships and prompted foreign partners to seek new ones. Are President Trump's trade policies a national security threat?
Well, this is an argument for everyone to get on my bill. So I'm hoping that this will result in a wave of co-sponsors and this thing will be carried to the House floor and the president will sign it into law. But listen, it's obvious to me, having heard from all of our partners directly, my background is in national security and foreign policy, and so I spend a lot of time thinking about our relations with the rest of the world, that, yes, people are concerned about the ongoing trade war with particularly with our allies. And as I articulated at the beginning, if we're to have any hope of being successful in this long-term competition with China that the Trump administration rightly identified, we have to tap into our unique source of strength, and that is our alliances. You have Chinese academics that are saying something very true right now, which is to say the core of competition for leadership of the world over the next three decades will come down to who has deeper friendships. So we start off from this position of massive advantage relative to the Chinese, and it's on us to maintain those alliances and build on those and act as the leader of the free world going forward, because we are the best hope for the world. We have enormous gifts and enormous responsibilities come with that. And so I'm actually optimistic about the U.S. over the long term, but we got to get a few big things right politically here over the next decade.
Well, Representative Mike Gallagher, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Stay warm.
Thank you very much for that. Representative Mike Gallagher represents the 8th Congressional District, talking to him about a number of issues, including tariffs and a tariff bill he introduced yesterday as part of bipartisan legislation. We'll be watching how that goes. And you can join us as we continue our conversations on the Ideas Network at 800-642-1234. Up next, it's news, and we'll talk about the growing conflict over who gets to live in America's cities, in America's urban areas. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're with us on The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. Talking about the crisis in finding affordable housing as we take a look inside America's big cities on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. House flipping, upscale neighborhood renovations, homeowners associations that insist on the status quo. We're looking at who gets to live in the nation's progressive big cities and who is excluded. And you're invited into the conversation at 800-642-1234. Has the high cost of living priced you out of a city? And if so, where did you go? Have you found yourself needing to move to a smaller community for cheaper living, even if it means a longer commute? What about affordable housing in cities? Have you tried to find it? Call in, email ideas at WPR.org. Randy Shaw is director of the Tenderloin Housing Clinic. That's a housing provider for homeless single adults in San Francisco. He's the author of Generation Priced Out, Who Gets to Live in the New Urban America. Randy, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me, Kate.
You write early in the book that the unaffordability of desirable, high employment cities basically defines urban America. Has it always been this way? What happened?
Well, it hasn't been this way. And really, places like San Francisco and New York City, you've been expensive for a long time. But now you have places like Austin and Seattle and Portland and Minneapolis and Denver, and you go on all the cities, like including Oakland, which sort of led me to write the book, because the ghost ship fire, December 2nd, 2016, 36 people die in a warehouse. And the question is, Oakland was always an affordable alternative to San Francisco, but now working and middle-class people can't even afford to live in Oakland. So there's definitely been a dramatic shift in who can live in our major cities since 2012, the second tech boom, so to speak.
And we're talking about both rent prices and housing prices, housing values. Is that right?
That is correct, and they're both connected. And it's both, they describe in Generation Price Out, it's both connected to a really artificially restricted supply over the last 30 to 40 years in all these cities, whereas population and jobs increased, nowhere near enough housing was built. So this is where we ended up.
Artificially restricted supply, where is that coming from?
Well, and this is one of the things I learned in writing the book. It comes because so many homeowner groups don't let apartments be built in their neighborhoods. I mean, in all the cities I just mentioned, in most of the cities, even in a city like San Francisco, which is known to be majority tenant, over half the city you cannot build an apartment. You can build a mansion, but you can't build a fourplex. Many of your listeners may recall that Minneapolis just passed something in December to stop single-family home exclusionary zoning, but that same process, that same law is applied to most of our major progressive cities, and it doesn't make any sense.
So you looked at San Francisco. You lived San Francisco. You are a housing activist in San Francisco. Where did that city go wrong? Because other big cities around the country say, oh, my gosh, we don't want to become the next San Francisco.
Right.
We don't want to become the next Manhattan. So what do you do to stop that slide?
Well, San Francisco has done a great job protecting tenants, a great job protecting its rental housing stock, and a terrible job at building housing. You know, if we just had a we still don't, you know, we build a few thousand units, but we add several thousand jobs. So when you're adding a population, our population has gone up 100,000 from the last census. We haven't added anywhere near that number of housing units just because, you know, we have homeowners in the city who decide they just don't want anything built and they don't want apartments. It's zoned so apartments can't be built. So how do cities add to their housing supply when you can't build apartments?
But isn't this come down to policy decisions? How can homeowners have that much say on who gets to live in their neighborhoods?
Well, that's the problem, is politically politicians often defer to homeowners. And one of the things I talk about in the book is how many cities have local elections where the turnout is very low or off-year elections and homeowners disproportionately vote. Los Angeles just changed that. They're going to all elections on even-numbered years. So there's a lot of reasons, but what we have to do is get the mentality to realize that you can't battle climate change. And look what you're going through in Wisconsin now and with the impacts of climate change. When you're not allowing infill housing and you're forcing people to make hour-long drive commutes to work, which just spews greenhouse gases and the like. So there's a big environmental issue here as well. It needs to say we have to override what these homeowner groups have been doing. And I talk in the book how the rise of the YIMBY, yes, in my backyard, the millennial YIMBYs have started to be a counterbalance to these homeowner groups.
We're looking at the housing crisis facing big cities today with soaring rents and housing prices. Randy Shaw is our guide. His book is Generation Priced Out, Who Gets to Live in the New Urban America. You have a voice at 800-642-1234. Is what we're talking here just the price you pay to live in a desirable urban area? Or do you think steps can be taken to make cities more equitable, more affordable? Bring your ideas, your housing reality at 800-642-1234. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. Randy, as I read your book, I certainly thought about my upbringing in Minneapolis, within the city, and my parents who bought their home in the 1960s with a deed I still have in a box of $16,500. There were taxes on that to the tune of $10 something for some taxes. Late in the life, they had to sell that house because of aging, having that as the last equity. And when you put my address in Zillow and I watched that house change, that transaction happen, and my bungalow being bulldozed and now a McMansion is there, I start to wonder how any cities can stop this, because you put Zillow into that address and the astronomical difference between the magnitude of what that house was worth and then those transactions and the flipping that happened and the escalation there. How do you stop that?
Well, I think I described the Generation Price that cities like Seattle have seen a sharp decline in home prices and in rents after they went up because so much supply comes on. You have to increase supply. You can't stop appreciation. But it used to be if you were a teacher, the teachers in San Francisco were in their 50s, the boomer teachers, they could buy a house in San Francisco in the 70s and 80s and even in the early 90s. Today, a teacher can't even afford an apartment in San Francisco, and that's true for many cities. So there's been a definite shift in the population groups. The middle class that always was able to afford to find neighborhoods in these high, even in the expensive cities, have been priced out because of it becomes a supply issue. And when you look at city after city, if in your parents' neighborhood in Minneapolis, if you can't build an apartment, then and only single-family homes, and the prices become very high. And if there's a limited supply because nothing can be built, you're guaranteed to see the kind of meteoric rise in boomer homeowner values and millennials pay the price, because as boomers' homes go up and up and up, millennials are stuck having to pay the higher prices from the scarcity.
Well, let's look at millennials here for a moment. You talk about this NIMBYism, not in my backyard. Homeowners may not want that new apartment complex coming into their neighborhood, especially if they think it's going to drive down the value of their home, which they may have a lot of money invested in. So how do you...
Well, actually, what's interesting, I didn't interrupt, I'm just saying what's interesting, Kate, is that so many of the neighborhoods in all the cities I write about in the book, there were apartments built and they exist. They're built in the 1920s, 1930s, and 1940s, and they haven't decreased anyone's value. It wasn't until the 70s, 60s, and 70s that these neighborhoods, many of them, passed these laws. Many of them had racial discriminatory laws. Once those were thrown out, they said, well, we'll keep renters out by only allowing single-family homes to get built. So a new form of exclusionary housing followed the ban on racial zoning.
Let's bring in a call now. Let's go to Mark joining us from Madison. Hi, Mark. What's on your mind here?
One of the problems we had in a community south of Madison was that there was some problem areas, a lot of police calls, a lot of gangs in some of the apartment buildings, and they deteriorated to a point that they were taken down, and that didn't do anything for the housing. I understand the housing problem. We also do have some very good managed apartment complexes, and I think that's the key to maintain the property values and the fear. It isn't always that it decreases the property value, but the fear of it is what people are afraid of.
Well, you know, it's interesting you mentioned that because there was a whole big debate in Minneapolis, and many of you might have followed that, just, you know, where people were saying, wait, just because I'm a renter doesn't mean I'm bad for your neighborhood. And this idea that people who rent are somehow inferior residents and don't care enough, that's just not, the facts don't support that. And facts also don't support declining values from having people who rent, particularly when they're renting a fourplex as opposed to a single family home.
So where does gentrification come in? And is this basically what we're seeing, gentrification on a widespread, large scale here?
Well, see, this is the main point of what I say in my book, I think, differs from others, which sort of identify gentrification with building some large luxury project and it displaces adjacent owner or adjacent residents. But really, the major cause of gentrification of neighborhoods is just not building. And so with the price keeps going up because of scarcity. And that's what we've seen in San Francisco and Los Angeles neighborhoods. And then when in Los Angeles, I show how in one neighborhood gets gentrified, people who are priced out of that go to the next neighborhood. And neighborhoods like Highland Park and Boyle Heights in Los Angeles that no one dreamed would ever be gentrified either have been or already at risk. So by not building more housing and more affordable housing, everything becomes at risk.
We are looking at ways urban areas can help stop pricing people out of living in big cities and preserve economic and racial diversity. The book is Generation Priced Out, Who Gets to Live in the New Urban America? And author Randy Shaw stays with us. Consider this. Amazon alone added 35,000 jobs in Seattle from 2010 to 2017. And Randy Shaw writes, no city can build enough housing to avoid rising rents and home prices from such massive local job growth. So what's a city to do? 800-642-1234 is the number. Have you needed to move to a smaller city for less expensive living, even if it meant a long commute? Call in. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. We'll get back to this discussion in a minute on the Ideas Network. Talking about the high cost of housing in America's big cities and how working people are often priced out of living in many of the country's most desirable areas. It's a conversation you hear on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Piece in the New York Times caught my eye at the start of 2019. It had this headline, Happy New Year. May your city never become San Francisco, New York, or Seattle, or Portland, Denver, Boston, Dallas, Houston, or Los Angeles. So this urban policy reporter went on to write that San Francisco had come to stand for the worst set of horrors. It's the place where extreme poverty and tech wealth occupy the same block while school teachers and firefighters live 2 hours away. How do you counter this? What do you do? What policies do you put in place that promote racial and economic diversity? 800-642-1234. Randy Shaw is our guide here. His book is Generation Priced Out, Who Gets to Live in the New Urban America. Let's go back to the phones now with Chris joining us from Fitchburg. Hi, Chris.
Hi. Well, I have some news. Madison is definitely on this list of exclusive cities. excuse me. And also, it's not just true for millennials. I live on Social Security disability income and a tiny pension. I worked for 20-some years, and then a semi-truck slammed into me. But people on Social Security income in general, older people, and just lower-income people in general, it's impossible to find housing here in Mass. That I moved here in October last year, and had I not had a small, and I'm talking small, amount of savings, I would not have been approved for any apartment in the greater Madison area.
Chris, thank you for that call. Randy, what do you hear there?
Well, I think one important point that the caller makes is that you know, the reality is my book is about people who have jobs, people who aren't eligible for federal housing assistance. But, you know, the big picture, 75% of eligible households in this country for federal housing assistance, because they don't earn enough money to afford rent, they don't get it, which is why we have a lot of, you know, people of all ages, either homeless or underhoused. And that's a federal issue. I'm talking about how cities can do more to house people who actually have jobs who aren't eligible. And the reason it tends to be more generational is that boomers were able to buy houses, and they didn't come out of college with $100,000 in debt like millennials now have to do. They were able to buy houses before the market went crazy or get apartments before they went crazy. And Madison, to my understanding, is more expensive rent-wise than Chicago. So Madison is exactly the kind of city that I'm talking about in my book that needs to make sure they implement the kind of policies I recommend a generation priced out.
Let's go to Jake now, joining us from Stevens Point. Jake, hi.
Yes, I just had a comment. My wife and I lived in Vancouver, Canada for a number of years, and we saw this firsthand. We were renting an 800-square-foot basement suite for in excess of $1,000, and part of what was driving their real estate market crazy was Chinese investment. And a lot of these properties were being built sort of for speculative investors and not actually being lived in. And I know as a city, they eventually got to the crux point where, once again, people were commuting in 2 or 3 hours. And I believe the city passed some legislation saying that, hey, you have to actually live in this residence for X number of months in order to be able to actually to own the residence.
The vacancy tax they passed, yes.
Yeah. So we actually moved from the West Coast back to Wisconsin. We were actually just floored at how cheap everything was.
And Jake, so you're in Stevens Point, which is a smaller community. How would you contrast that with West Coast or Vancouver?
I would say that our quality of life is better or identical. Our dollars definitely go a lot further. Granted, you're not going to have some of the amenities that we miss in the city, say, you know, really high-quality food, diversity, accessibility to the mountains, ocean, everything else. But long story short, I think our number one factor was obviously family.
So, Randy, there are trade-offs here.
Yeah, I mean, the challenge is that the cities are the place where the high-paying jobs, educational, and cultural opportunities are. So often people don't have a choice to move to a more affordable city. That the reason there's so much long commutes to the Bay Area in San Francisco, and why there's 120,000 people commuting to Sacramento, which is an hour and a half away, is people are living in the smaller cities so they can get affordable housing, but then the consequence for the environment and for their own lives is a very long commute. And that's sort of not what we really want in this era of climate change, and it's also not healthy for just people's family life to be away on the road so long. So many people are moving. That's why we have these long commutes, because they're following the exact mood of your caller to move to a more affordable small city.
Let's pivot now to some solutions here that you see. You worked in this area a long time. What can be done in your eyes to ensure that affordable housing is built? We see the housing crunch. What do we do about it?
Well, every city that in America should make sure that apartments are legalized in all neighborhoods. You should be able to build a fourplex in every neighborhood instead of a mansion. And that seems sort of obvious. Mansions are not, there's no shortage of housing for wealthy people. The They also need to build more affordable housing and protect their existing supply, because many cities still allow apartments to be demolished. I describe in my book how Austin, Texas, the owner decided they wanted to demolish a 240-unit apartment building housing loan to families. 6 months later, it was demolished. You can't lose your existing supply, and that just creates more displacement and the like. So there's many things cities can do to expand their supply. Put housing bonds on the ballot to raise the money if the federal government and the state government isn't doing so. But it requires a sense of urgency. That's why I wrote Generation Priced Out. It's sort of a call to action to say something is very wrong when teachers, nurses, firefighters can no longer afford to live in the cities they work, and we have to start taking action.
What about protections for renters? How might that help?
I'm sorry?
What about protections for renters? That be of help?
No, and many in California, you can have rent control, and so many cities do, and San Francisco has the most extensive protection for renters of any city in the country. And other cities are often banned by their state governments from imposing protections for tenants. But clearly, you can't advance your city's economic and racial diversity if you're allowing people on 30 or 60 days notice just to be thrown out of their longtime home. So that's not an effective strategy, and it's not a moral strategy, and it's not one any progressive city should accept.
So, Randy, can you give us an example of an American city that's getting it right?
Well, I would say that Seattle is doing the best. Seattle and Denver are both building enough housing. The Amazon problem was through Seattle out of balance temporarily. But what Seattle is also doing is protecting tenants by giving density bonuses so that a developer can build two stories higher in exchange for protecting tenants and having their affordability. And I think that's a very good way for cities who can't do rent control to add housing and add affordable housing by increasing density. But as long as we only allow single-family homes, as long as we only allow duplexes, don't allow like fourplexes, eightplexes, 10-unit buildings to be built, we're never going to deal with the population increase that we're having as rents continue to go up. So everybody should be in favor of building more housing.
As we look to wrap up here, a lot of people may think, I'm just one person. What can I do? So what can individuals do here at a grassroots level if they're concerned about rising costs in their city?
That's a great question. I described in the book in city after city how individual people just started to take action to say, wait a second, we need to build more housing. And the homeowners are wrong. And we've seen city after city, I described in the book, from Cambridge to San Diego to all these cities that have not had a history of activism, people are getting active. It's making a difference. So I think people in Madison and in Milwaukee, people who are hearing this, should be getting involved, because it makes a big difference when you get involved. And you can learn more about my book at generationpricedout.com and get all about all kinds of stuff. So people can take a look at that.
Randy, thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you so much for having me, and I hope you guys get some warmer weather ahead.
Thank you. Randy Shaw is director of the Tenderloin Housing Clinic, a housing provider for homeless single adults in San Francisco. He's the author of Generation Priced Out, Who Gets to Live in the New Urban America? Just ahead, coyotes don't just live in the wild. They're also showing up in urban areas and cities in Wisconsin. We'll hear a Wisconsin life story that takes us along with a group of scientists in the field studying the coyotes. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're with us on The Morning Show. It is the Ideas Network.